Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a channel on the New Books Network. This is a podcast for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Robin Morse, from the University of Virginia. Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Matthew Hopper, author of Slaves of One Master, Globalization and Slavery in Arabia in the Age of Empire, published by Yale University Press in 2015. Dr. Hopper is a professor of history at California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo. His book, Slaves of One Master, was finalist for the 2016 Frederick Douglass Book Prize. In this wide-ranging history of African diaspora and slavery in Arabia in the 19th and early 20th centuries, Matthew S. Hopper examines the interconnected themes of enslavement, globalization, and empire, and challenges the previously held conventions regarding Middle East slavery and British imperialism. Whereas conventional historiography regards the Indian Ocean slave trade as fundamentally different from its Atlantic counterpart, Hopper's study argues that both systems were influenced by global economic forces. Hopper's book links the personal stories of enslaved Africans to the impersonal global commodity chains their labor enabled, demonstrating how the growing demand for workers created a global demand for Persian Gulf products, compelled the enslavement of these people and their transportation to Eastern Arabia. Welcome, Matt, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your book.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Can you start us off by saying a few words about yourself and how you got interested in this subject?
Yeah, thanks. I think, like a lot of historians, my path to becoming a history professor and becoming a researcher in history and an author was kind of a circuitous route. I was a graduate student in history at Temple University in Philadelphia and was working on a project originally on the Congo. And I had been studying Swahili. And I had become increasingly interested in Eastern Congo, and that took me into an interest in East Africa. And I reached out to a historian at UCLA, Edward Alpers, who was willing to take me on as a graduate student in a second master's program in African studies. And then I ended up continuing to work with him in the PhD program. And I knew his work, and I knew about him. What I didn't know was how brilliant he was, and what a nice guy he was. And he took me under his wing, and he mentored me, and in many ways just guided me to this project that ended up becoming this book. So like many first authors, my first book is based on my dissertation, and Ned Alpers was the sort of the unnamed co-author and architect behind this. So he steered me in the direction of the history of the African diaspora in the Indian Ocean. He spent a good part of his life studying the history of slavery in the Indian Ocean and pointed out to me that with a background in Swahili, and by this point I was also studying Arabic, that I would be ideally situated to do a study of the African diaspora in the Gulf. And so I originally thought I might study the history of the Congo, and I was interested especially in what Americans were doing in the Congo. But as I worked more and more with Ned Alpers, I increasingly became interested in the East African coast and Zanzibar. And then with his guidance, that took me further afield, further out into the Western Indian Ocean, into Southern Arabia and the Gulf.
So let's now turn to your book, Slaves of One Master. How did this book idea develop? What was the research process like connecting archives in East Africa and the Persian Gulf?
Yeah, thanks. The research process was somewhat of a long one. So I ended up doing a couple of years of language study at UCLA in Swahili and in Arabic, including a couple of intensive studies abroad. One was in Morogoro, Tanzania for Swahili, and then another was in Sana'a in Yemen for Arabic. And I originally planned to do a pre-dissertation year in Yemen and Oman, and that was based in part on what ended up being kind of a misguided idea that that Southern Arabia sort of held together as a as a unit, and that ended up not really being the case. Ended up that I realized that the slave trade to Oman and the slave trade to Yemen were, although linked, to largely different processes. And so it ended up not really being appropriate to study both Yemen and Oman simultaneously or in the same study. But I was in Yemen on September 11th, 2001, studying Arabic, and that immediately disrupted any plans to do archival research in Yemen anyway. And so when I relocated to Oman, which actually was a planned relocation, and began doing my work there, I was originally mostly interested in seeing where communities of African descent lived today. And so my research process that first year involved renting a little Volkswagen Polo, which sort of looks like a golf or a rabbit. And I drove it, I think, to the best of my knowledge, on every paved road in Oman. I went everywhere trying to see where the descendants of enslaved Africans lived today. And I ended up spending a significant amount of time on the Batna coast, which is sort of the northern coast of Oman, and then in the area around Sur and Ras Al Had, and then some time in Sharqiya and Dahra as well, so more in the interior. But I was surprised to see that there were so many descendants of enslaved Africans who were living in that Batna region, and that sort of sparked a curiosity that was later satisfied by archival work mostly in the UK. I also did a second research year, and that was sort of split between Zanzibar and the UK, and spent the better part of the year working in the British Library and the National Archives, as well as in the Zanzibar Archives. And so those were the main archival collections that I worked in, but I ended up doing research in, I think, more than 20 different repositories and more than six different countries. And so that included some of the officials who were actually witnessing the Indian Ocean slave trade in the 1860s, whose papers ended up in Edinburgh, missionaries whose papers ended up in Birmingham, and then some Americans who were present in the region, and their papers ended up far afield in places like Wyoming and New Jersey. And so the archival research really spanned a number of countries and repositories. And the research process that began in a Volkswagen Polo really ended in the archives as I began reading the accounts of enslaved Africans in their own words. And those were recorded in manumission testimonies. And that's what became sort of the main source base for tracing the lives of enslaved Africans in the Gulf. Their testimonies given in exchange for a certificate of manumission, largely in the 1920s and 1930s. In East Africa, the sources were quite rich, and there are a number of Arabic documents that are preserved in those archives, as well as in microfilm form in the British Library in the India Office papers, that provide some clues about how the Indian Ocean slave trade operated. But the most, but the richest sources for me ended up being colonial materials contained in the National Archives in the UK and in the India Office records in the British Library. So I spent many happy hour working away in those two places. And at the time, photography wasn't allowed in the British Library. So all of my notes were notes that I made on a little laptop computer while reading these. And so now they do allow photography. So there are a number of other researchers who are following up. And I hope with their diligence, we'll have a number of other studies that kind of take what I try to do in this book to the next level.
Thank you for elaborating on that further. It'll be very important for other scholars to learn from what you did. So in your book, you argue for new perspectives regarding the Persian Gulf. And in order to do that, you tie pre-oil developments in the Gulf to slavery and globalization in the Indian Ocean. Can you chart for our listeners how this came to be and why you argue for further analysis of pre-oil Persian Gulf?
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you pick up a guidebook for any of the countries in the Gulf, the typical cover will juxtapose something that's quote-unquote traditional in front of something that's quote-unquote modern, right? So you'll have maybe what's called sometimes referred to as a traditional dhow, but in the background you'll have this sparkling skyline of a pristine modern city. Or one of my favorites on a postcard is a camel in the back of a pickup truck. And these are intended, right, these images are intended to be jarring, right? The person who's showing us the photograph intends to juxtapose traditional and modern. It's tempting to think about the development of the Gulf in that way, something that sort of is a stark contrast with the past that sort of comes out of nowhere. And some of the guidebooks actually do use phrases like that, like just sort of, you know, emerge in a moment or in overnight, these successful thriving cities and countries in the Gulf. And in some ways, I think that's really problematic because it erases a part of the history of the Gulf that I think is quite important. And that is, there is an earlier period of globalization that generates, at least in some circles, a tremendous amount of wealth. And many of the cities in the Gulf become sources of great wealth and become centers of expanding populations and expanding architecture in the late 19th and early 20th century. And what's driving that growth are two key industries that initially are focused on the Gulf region. They're the pearl industry and the date industry. And for centuries, those two commodities had huge markets in India and in the Middle East, the area immediately surrounding the Gulf. So there was a huge regional economy. But it became globalized in the late 19th century as American, European, Asian merchants would come to the Gulf to get these commodities. And it became both of the industries essentially became globalized in that period. And it's in that period we also see a dramatic expansion of the Indian Ocean slave trade. And the particular focus, at least in the initial years of that, the initial target for slave labor is East Africa. And there are longstanding connections with East Africa and the Gulf. And so in many ways, this it's not a surprising outcome that the East Africa become the primary focus. But what is surprising is the huge increase in the number of enslaved Africans who began arriving in the late 19th century. And in some ways, I think this is important to draw connections to what happened in the Atlantic world over a century earlier, that it's not so much anything cultural or religious about the Gulf that makes it the center for the slave trade, any more than in the Atlantic, it's cultural or religion that's driving the transatlantic slave trade. Instead, it's economics. It's the global economic demand for things like sugar, and then later cotton, tobacco, coffee, other things produced in the New World, but especially sugar, that is creating demand for enslaved African labor. Something similar is happening in the Western Indian Ocean. And historians have done a nice job of tracking what happens in East Africa as East African commodities become globalized and expand to reach far-flung markets in places like the United States, Europe, Singapore. But we knew much less, I think, about the Gulf. So that made it a particular particularly exciting place for me to study. Because if you visit the Gulf and visit the museums, many of the museum exhibits depict a sharp contrast between the present and the past, but also celebrate certain aspects of the past, especially the traditions of harvesting dates and pearls. And for me, it was interesting to see how few of these exhibits highlighted the significance of enslaved African labor. And this, for me, kind of created a mystery that needed to be solved, or and some detective work that needed to be done. I think often when people think about the Gulf too, when they've thought about the history of slavery, they've thought about it in the broader context of slavery in the Middle East. And there are some ways in which the Gulf fits very nicely into that broader paradigm, but in some ways it complicates it significantly. And it certainly is the case that in the broader history of Islam, slavery has existed in many Islamic societies. And in many of those societies, Islam improves the life of people who are enslaved by providing them with personhood and legal obligations that have to be respected. Families, for example, aren't supposed to be split up. People who are Muslims are not supposed to be enslaved. Manumission is encouraged. Most of the references to slavery in the Quran are toward encouraging manumission. And so in many ways, the Gulf fits nicely into that paradigm. But many of the expectations that Western scholars have about slavery in the Middle East are complicated by the situation in the Gulf. For example, looking broadly at the history of slavery in the Middle East, a Western scholar might expect that the slavery would tend to emphasize elites, people who are retainers or domestic workers, soldiers, concubines, harem slaves. These kinds of elites, especially soldiers, are highlighted throughout the history of the Middle East. But something different happens in the Gulf, although some aspects of slavery do look a bit like what you might expect, knowing the historiography of slavery in the Middle East. There are other aspects that look a lot more like Atlantic slavery. So, for example, in the late 19th century, it wouldn't be uncommon for people to be working in productive industries rather than being in elite positions. Many people were certainly working in hauling water and construction and as domestic workers, but a very large number are involved in the production of dates and pearls. And these are the commodities that are finding their way to global markets all around the world. So for me, this created a question that needed to be answered, or at least needed to be researched further. And that's what really got me excited about this project, that and tracing the lives of people whose voices I felt needed to be heard and whose lives I felt needed to be explored brought to the attention, I think, of a broader readership.
So, as you briefly mentioned, the East African slave trade provides a really crucial element for your argument. How did this particular trade corridor influence life and economy in the Persian Gulf? And were there specific nuances that defined interactions between East Africa and the Gulf regarding slavery specifically?
Yeah, it's interesting. We tend to think of the Indian Ocean slave trade and Atlantic slavery as two fundamentally different things, but there's a tremendous amount of overlap. And so what I like to emphasize is that the slave trade in the Indian Ocean doesn't just overlap with the Atlantic slave trade. There are certainly European slave traders as early as the 16th century who are bringing people from Madagascar and Mozambique to markets in the Atlantic and the New World. That's happening very early on. But on top of that, there's also there's a process where the Atlantic slave trade actually leads to an increase in an Indian Ocean slave trade, and that demands some explanation. So Portuguese, Spanish, Brazilian slave traders, French slave traders would visit the southeastern coast of Africa and the island of Madagascar, and especially after the islands of Mauritius and Reunion begin to be colonized by Europeans. There's a demand for slave labor to produce sugar So Ned Alpers likes to refer to Mauritius and Reunion as Caribbean islands in the wrong ocean. And I think in many ways this is really correct. But Europeans begin targeting southeastern Africa to populate and provide labor for those two islands. But they're also bringing tremendous numbers. At least 500,000 Africans are taken from southeastern Africa around the Cape of Good Hope to the Americas by the time we get to the middle of the 19th century. And what happens is with British abolitionism and the increased patrols of the Mozambique Channel, this makes it increasingly risky for European slave traders to trade in that region. It's around that time that the two key commodities in the Gulf, dates and pearls, are expanding in order to meet rising global demand. And so it's just at the moment that this slave trade in southeastern Africa is being shut down to Europeans that people from the Gulf, many of whom have settled on the coast of East Africa, begin using slave labor in places like Zanzibar to produce other tropical commodities that can find global markets, things like cloves, for example. And what's fascinating for me about this is the people in Europe and the United States who are purchasing these commodities, cloves, dates, pearls, they're not thinking about these commodities as being produced by slaves. And so they're happily consuming these things while also advocating for abolition. And nobody seems to be making the direct connection at the time that a decrease in the slave trade to the Atlantic is actually coinciding with an increase in a slave trade within East Africa, concentrated on the coast, but then especially to the northward, into the Western Indian Ocean, going to places like Oman, Yemen, the Emirates, and further afield into the Gulf. And so, in fact, the two histories are interconnected, the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. And so in some ways, we have to think about these two things together. But there's also a connection between the Gulf and East Africa that goes back to at least the 11th century. And that's that the monsoon winds of the Western Indian Ocean tend seasonally to take one, if you were to get in a dhow, leave in a ship from the Gulf certain times of the year, the winds and currents are going to take you to East Africa. And then the winds and currents will reverse, and that allows people to predictably return home the following year. And so there's a longstanding connection between these two regions. It's a trade connection. It's a migration connection. There are people from the Gulf who are settling in that region. And we know that there are people from East Africa who are enslaved in the Gulf region, for centuries. But the numbers are inconsistent. It's impossible to say that at the peak of the Indian Ocean slave trade in the 1860s, when thousands of people are ending up in the Gulf, it's impossible to say that that trade was consistent going back for centuries and centuries. Historians who have made that kind of guess, because they know something about the revolt in the Abbasid Caliphate, in the medieval period, and they know something about abolitionism in East Africa in the 1860s. The historians who have tried to say that, as Copeland famously said, that the history of slavery runs like a scarlet thread throughout the history of East Africa, I think is really misleading. Instead, this is something that has to do with supply and with demand. There are times when the outbreaks of disease or famine or climate disruption in East Africa might, to put it crudely, create an increased supply of people who might be enslaved. But then there's also something that must be said also for the demand. There's a relatively small population in the Gulf and now a surging demand for Gulf commodities. And this leads to a labor shortage that leads people in the Gulf increasingly to target East Africa as a source for enslaved African labor.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So let's turn to these commodities you keep discussing, the dates and the pearls. So I imagine most listeners are familiar with California-produced dates, rather than the ones originating from the Middle East or North Africa, more common in American supermarkets. In your discussion of the date economy and its ebb and flow, you trace how economic factors in the Gulf influence the establishment of California date farms. How does a story about globalization and slavery in the Gulf lead to California?
Yeah, I found this really fascinating because having grown up in California, if you visit California, you know that we have a lot of these farmers markets. And when you go to the farmers markets, there's often a table or two of people who are selling dates. And the dates come from the Coachella Valley for the most part. And it's tempting to think that these dates originate in the Coachella Valley. And it turns out they actually have a fascinating history. And it's one that connects back to the history of the Gulf. So beginning in the early 19th century, Americans become crazy about dates. And this is difficult for us to understand today in an age of mass manufactured sweets. But there was no Hershey bar before 1900. And in the 19th century, when Americans wanted to satisfy their sweet teeth, they might turn to dried fruit. Dates are sweet, they're hearty, they're nutritious, they're rich in sugar and very flavorful. And Americans became obsessed with dates. We're not sure exactly when the earliest shipment of dates comes to the United States, but it must have been very early in the country's history, the early 19th century. These dates were so popular that the first ships to arrive in ports like Salem, Boston, and New York would fetch the highest prices. And so American sailors from places like Salem and New York would sail into the Indian Ocean to get dates. And it seems kind of crazy for us to think about, but people want to sail thousands of miles just to get these sweets. But they functioned in two ways. On one hand, there was a big market for them in the U.S. People love these, especially around the holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. That's when Americans consumed most of their dates. And so these ships would race back in order to try to corner the market by delivering these cargoes of dates early. But they also served as ballast. So you could actually sail in ballast with stone and then unload the stone into the harbor in Muscat and then board, load tons, literally tons of dates, baskets full of dates and woven bags full of dates. These ships would often come with other commodities as well. They would go to Aden and Mocha to get coffee. They'd go to Zanzibar to get cloves and ivory. But no ship wanted to return without some dates. So if they could replace their ballast with dates, this was an extra source of income for them. These ships would race around the Cape of Good Hope and make it back to the eastern seaboard of the United States, where the dates would then circulate all around the country. So what happens is, as Americans are consuming more and more dates, there's still a population in India, the old primary market for dates in the Gulf. And so this increased demand leads to an increase in production. And so more and more date groves are planted, that more and more dates are being harvested and shipped out of ports like Muscat and Matra. And there ends up not being enough supply. And so as a result, prices begin to increase. And the one date variety that's particularly appealing to Americans, the one that's the most popular, is this date known as the Fard date. And the Fard date is so important because it ripens early enough for the ships to make it back in time for the holidays. And it's also very sweet. And so it becomes very expensive. More and more of these varieties are planted. Other similar varieties begin to be expanded in the Botnia region. And this ends up creating a demand for additional labor. And that inspires an expansion of the slave trade with East Africa. But Americans are interested not just in dates from Oman, they increasingly gain an appetite for what are called golden dates. And these are the ones that are produced in Basra and Baghdad. And with the opening of the Suez Canal and the expansion of steam traffic, more and more American vessels sail up into the Gulf, and they get both the golden varieties coming from Iraq and these Fard than other varieties coming from Oman. And more and more ships come into the fruit docks of Brooklyn and unload literally tons and tons of these dates. And some American merchants get the idea that perhaps these dates don't need to come all the way from the Gulf. Perhaps they could be grown somewhere here in the United States. And so it's actually the federal government through the USDA that sends the earliest plant explorers into the region as the United States is looking to find crops that could be grown in Southern California and parts of Arizona. So to grow dates, you need extremely hot temperatures, but you also need a good supply of water. Well, Southern California has got the temperatures, it's got plenty of sunlight, it's got the high temperatures, especially in the interior of Southern California, and Arizona has plenty of heat. So the dates could certainly be grown there if they could have a source of water. And so what ends up happening is increasing irrigation on the Colorado River leads ultimately to the accidental construction of the Salton Sea. They're in the middle of constructing dams and irrigation channels when in the early 20th century, when some of these levees break, and for several months, the Colorado River is basically entirely diverted into Southern California, and it creates this artificial lake. I'm actually historically, there actually was a lake there in very ancient times, but that whole basin fills in with water before they're eventually able to correct the problem. And more water is diverted from the Colorado into Southern California. It becomes a really, through irrigation channels and things like that, it becomes a really ideal environment to grow dates. And so the United States sends somebody by the name of David Fairchild into the Gulf, and he brings back some early samples of offshoots of dates. And very quickly, plant scientists discover if you want to grow date trees, you can't just plant a date pit. You really need an offshoot from a healthy tree. Otherwise, there's no guarantee of the product you're going to get. And so David Fairchild visits several places in the Gulf. He visits Bahrain and Oman and Basra, and he brings back some offshoots. And these do very well at experimental stations in the American Southwest. And he's followed by a guy called Paul Popenoe, who's not officially working on behalf of the government. He's a private entrepreneur, but he's based in an area around Pasadena, and he owns some property in the Coachella Valley. And he brings back literally hundreds and hundreds of date offshoots from the Gulf. He's able to package these things up, including some of the really valuable varieties. And he brings these back and has them planted in California, along with some of the offshoots that Fairchild had brought back. And in the early 20th century, for the first time, you begin to get date harvests in California. And these dates catch on and eventually come to replace all these dates that are being imported from the Gulf. So if we think about dates today, we think about our California dates, but they were non-existent before the early 20th century. And this actually has a serious impact on the Gulf economy, as we'll get to in the later chapters. I talk about the period around the Great Depression. It happens to coincide with the collapse of the pearl market. So dates and pearls sort of rise together, and they collapse almost simultaneously, which has a devastating effect on the Gulf economy. It also will contribute to a gradual end to the slave trade from East Africa.
So before we get to the end and the decline of these trades, let's look at pearls. The book's title is taken from a comment from a ruler in Qatar to a British official in 1863. Quote, "We are all, from the highest to the lowest, slaves of one master, the pearl." Why did you choose this title, and how does pearling connect slavery and globalization in the Persian Gulf?
Yeah, I was struck by that quote. So Palgrave, who's traveling in the Gulf in the 1860s, ends up meeting with a man who's effectively the sheikh of the region we today would call Qatar. And this is really the epicenter of the Gulf's pearl industry. Most of the productive pearl beds are in the shallow waters in this area north of the United Arab Emirates and between Qatar and Bahrain. They tend to be on that western side of the Gulf, but especially concentrated in this area. So here's somebody who has witnessed the meteoric rise of global demand for pearls. And he feels like, at least his comment expresses that he feels almost like his hands are tied, like that all of them, even elites like him, are enslaved to the pearl. And he's saying this, I think, in part because he recognizes that the whole region has become effectively dependent on the pearl industry. Pearls have become far and away the most important commodity from the region. But there's also a certain irony in that comment, and that is because there is a very real difference between slaves and free in the Gulf. And so he's saying this in one hand to highlight the economic dependence that the region has on global markets, but he's also masking the very real inequalities that exist in the Gulf. And I think that sort of the irony and the reality of that quote, I think, drew me to it. And it's sort of, in some ways, kind of opens up the conversation about the economic impacts of global markets, but also the very real presence of enslaved people in the region. So the background to this is the rapid expansion of the pearl industry. Pearls had been wildly popular in early modern Europe. Kings and queens would wear pearls as pins or brooches or necklaces and in crowns. And these pearls were initially coming from these newly colonized areas like Venezuela in the Caribbean, places like the northern coast of South America and the island of Sri Lanka or Ceylon in the Indian Ocean. And all these pearls were circulating around Europe, became widely popular. But then during the revolutionary period, they became very unpopular. They became sort of a symbol of excessive wealth, and they became very unfashionable. And that situation existed for several decades before pearls end up being revived. And this happens in the late 19th century. And certain elites begin wearing pearls again, and they become fashionable with around the time of Queen Victoria and Empress Eugenie in France. Queen Victoria was frequently depicted wearing a long pearl necklace. And then following Victoria, Alexandra would wear a pearl necklace, very almost like a dog collar, thick one. That was in part to kind of hide a blemish on her neck. But as people began to see photographs of these elites wearing them, the fashion of pearls was revived. And pretty soon, everybody wanted to wear pearl necklaces, and especially the wealthy, the nouveau riche, the steel and copper and railroad magnates in the United States wanted to decorate members of their family with long pearl necklaces. The longer, the better. The more ornate, the better. And so there's this new surging demand for pearls. But by the close of the 19th century, the world's leading producer of pearls is the Gulf. And what we don't often think about is that many of the people who were diving for these pearls were enslaved Africans. Many of them had been enslaved as boys, brought from places like Zanzibar and East Africa, were raised maybe producing things like dates, irrigating date plantations, date gardens in places like Botnia. And when they became old enough to go diving for pearls, probably sometime around the age of 15, they would be sent pearl diving. And these pearl divers would work long days throughout the pearling season, certain months of a warmer months of the year, and in excessive heat and in pretty challenging depths and really challenging conditions with, stingrays and jellyfish, risking their lives to pull these pearls out for consumers who probably weren't thinking very much about the people who were actually producing these pearls. So in terms of value, it's estimated that at the turn of the 20th century, the Gulf was producing more pearls than all other parts of the world combined. It was really the epicenter of the pearling industry. And so the whole economy came to revolve around pearling. In places like Bahrain and Qatar, it's estimated that just about every male had some involvement in the pearling industry. And people who are capable of going diving for pearls were already doing that. And it's in that period of the late 19th century that there's an increased demand for more pearl divers. And I hypothesize in the book that that leads to an increase in demand for slave labor, and increasingly are looking to East Africa to supply it.
Great. So after discussing these large macro flows of capital, let us now turn to the major actors in these stories, and most importantly, the voices and experiences of the enslaved whose labor is being exploited. What was daily life like for these men and women as dates and pearls traveled out of the Gulf?
Yeah, so the focus of the book is the enslaved Africans who are doing the labor that supports these two key industries. But there are a lot more Africans in the Gulf than just in these two industries. I'm highlighting these two because I think these two industries are the focus of the economy, and because I think they're generating the largest source of demand for African labor. But Africans are doing a number of things. So if we think about the typical life for somebody who's enslaved, the photographs from the early 20th century indicate that enslaved people went around barefoot. They weren't culturally, it was frowned upon them to wear shoes. So they would be identifiable by being barefoot, and usually wearing, males would wear something very simple that would look something like a loin cloth or a wrap that would just cover their lower waist. Many of the males would work in irrigation and in elsewhere in the date industry. So although it seems like you would just grow a date palm and then just harvest the dates when the time's appropriate. In fact, it's actually really labor intensive. So a lot of men would work in pollinating, harvesting, the date palms, clearing the offshoots off of date palms, planting additional ones. But the bulk of the labor is actually irrigating these palms. And that's because this is a region of the world that tends to be fairly arid. And the sources of water tend to be underground or in artesian wells in the hills and mountains. And so those natural springs that are in the mountains can be channeled through something called the fallaj system. And those channels irrigated date palms in places like the Smail Valley and in the Dahra region of Oman. But Batna, which is the greatest area of expansion of date production and also the greatest area of demand for African labor, the situation is quite different. There is water, but it is deep underground. And so wells would have to be dug. And then the water has to be lifted out of these wells. And so people in the Gulf very cleverly devised a system of pulleys. So if you can kind of imagine a large structure which would support a pulley, and that pulley would be connected to a rope on one end, would have not a bucket, but usually a bladder made out of animal skins, and would bring up several gallons of water per scoop. But on the other end of that pulley would be an ox or donkey who would be led down a artificially created pit, sort of a ramp. And so as the animal would descend down the ramp, the work of pulling the rope over the pulley and lifting the water out of the well and into these channels was done. But the animal won't do it voluntarily. It has to be guided. And so around the clock, African men especially would be leading the, often in chains, we're told, would be leading these animals up and down this ramp repeatedly in order to irrigate these state channels, while other men would plug one channel and divert it elsewhere in order to make sure that all of the date palms received sufficient water to ensure production. And so we have descriptions from Western observers that often these men were in chains and that the screeching sound of the pulley could be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, everywhere in the Botswana region, and that there were tens of thousands of these pulleys working simultaneously. And so people traveling through the region would describe the almost musical sound of these pulleys working. So a lot of people, a lot of enslaved Africans were working in that industry. For people working in purling, it was the grueling work of diving, but also the support staff for the divers involved somebody who in English we would say was a puller. And if you can kind of imagine a purl diver would descend to the ocean floor with the assistance of a heavy weight. And there'd be on board, there'd be several different weights, you know, for people of various builds and weights. And that would take them down to the ocean floor, and they would then free themselves of the weight and using a basket, collect as many pearl oysters as possible, prying them off of the seafloor. Then they would tug on a separate rope, which was tied around their waist. And that rope would, when tugged, would indicate to the puller that it was time to come up, that the person was just about out of air. And so the puller's job was to very swiftly pull that person up to the surface where then they could rest. And after a short rest, then descend with the weight and do this repeatedly all day long. So the descriptions we have from the 19th century of the pullers and the divers, it's impossible to gauge exactly how many are African slaves or who are people of African descent. But at least a quarter and possibly as many as a half of these divers were enslaved Africans and their descendants. And so many of them were working in this grueling industry as well. Aboard the ship, they would have to open the shells, clear out the stinky flesh of the oysters, heap all this up, and pass the pearls to the pearling captain, who then would sell them when they returned to shore. And they would be away from shore for weeks and even months at a time. And so that work was especially grueling. But people worked in all kinds of different other sectors, construction, hauling water. Many women worked in childcare and domestic work, cleaning and cooking and the like. And so people would often live as part of their master's household or compound, but often separate from the family. Some people were treated remarkably well. We have stories of people who were treated like family, but very often as sort of like a junior member of the family. And we also have horrific accounts of abuse. People who were branded with hot irons, people who were manacled. We have descriptions, especially from the manumission testimonies, of people being whipped for not working, people being beaten severely for not being able to go pearl diving on account of an illness or injury. We have all kinds of really horrifying accounts of abuse. And I think in this way, it's sort of jarring for people who have an assumption that you know, slavery looks very different in the Middle East than it does in the Atlantic, because some of this actually looks quite similar, at least in the late 19th and early 20th century, when the soaring demand for dates and pearls has led to increased demand for African labor. And many of these Africans are being horribly mistreated, and they recount that in their own testimonies. And so I think there's a lot that could be said. And in one chapter of the book, I go into a lot more detail about the kinds of abuse people endured and the kinds of lives that they would expect. We also do have some almost heartwarming accounts of people being well-treated. So I would say if there's one word to describe the treatment of enslaved Africans in the Gulf, it's diverse. The treatment is diverse. It really ranges from where people are, which particular parts of the Gulf, which particular seasons and which industries they're working in, and also the people who are, you know, claiming them as their slaves. Those people, you know, could be you know, quite abusive. Others, you know, less so. So I think the experience is quite diverse. I open one of the chapters of the book with a story about a woman who comes looking for a runaway slave who has escaped and is complaining to a British official that his master, this woman, has not found him a wife, and therefore he's seeking his freedom. And she comes begging for him back and promising him a wife. So there are, you know, all, I think there are as many people who are enslaved. There are that many different experiences, and I think for some people it's a experience of horrific abuse, and for others, some people are much better treated. But I would say the experiences are as diverse as there are people enslaved.
Thank you. And so, as we previously mentioned, your book follows the growth and decline of both the pearling and date industries in the Persian Gulf in the 19th and 20th centuries. How does this discussion of the relationship between the East African slave trade and the Persian Gulf end?
Right. When we think about the history of abolition, it's tempting to put all of the focus on the British Royal Navy. And to be sure, Royal Navy vessels patrolled the Western Indian Ocean. There weren't a lot of them. They didn't make a lot of captures. But we think in the broader history of the 19th century Indian Ocean, about between 20 and 30,000 African captives were taken off of slave vessels by the Royal Navy. And that's a lot. But there were other factors at play that contributed to the end of the Indian Ocean slave trade or the East African slave trade. So certainly European imperialism and colonialism is a part of the conversation. Certainly the Royal Navy's role is significant, but there's also an economic contribution that comes from the Great Depression. Around the same time, the date industry and the pearl industry collapse, and with it, so too does the demand for slave labor. When the dates begin to be produced in California, this undercuts the Gulf's market, international market for dates. And this has a devastating impact on producers and the economy in the region. It happens to be almost simultaneous with the collapse of the pearl market. Pearls up until the early 20th century were all natural pearls, but Mikimoto in Japan patents a process building on a longstanding Chinese tradition of inserting spherical pieces of shell into pearl oysters in order to produce cultured pearls, what we today would call cultured pearls. And he begins mass producing them in the early 20th century. And they begin to flood global markets, even get mixed in together with natural pearls coming from the Gulf. And to the naked eye, you and I could not distinguish between a natural pearl and a cultured pearl. You have to basically look at it with an X-ray or be a real expert, a jeweler as an expert. But to the untrained eye, they're identical. They're indistinguishable. And so they begin to be mixed together. And eventually the value of natural pearls plummets dramatically around the time of the Great Depression. And with the added impetus of the Great Depression, combined with the collapse of the date market, the end of pearling really just devastates the Gulf economy. And so this certainly contributes to the end of the East African slave trade. With the end of these two industries, or at least the collapse of these two industries almost simultaneously, there's a collapse in demand for African labor, and this is going to lead to a simultaneous collapse of the East African slave trade. To be sure, there are some records of ships later into the 20th century that continue to bring African captives to the Gulf. That certainly does happen, but the numbers are very small compared to what we saw at the peak of these industries in late 19th, around the turn of the century. So there are a number of factors at play with the end of the East African slave trade. The history of East Africa and the Gulf are in some ways intertwined through the history of British colonialism, but I think in many ways historians have put too much weight on the efforts of the Royal Navy and less weight than I think is appropriate when it comes to the economic factors, if that makes sense.
While the book examines the economic flows of capital around the world, your work specifically focuses on the role of the African diaspora, both freed and enslaved, within these events. The Gulf currently markets itself as a cosmopolitan society, but still very Arab at its core. How is the legacy of slavery and the African diaspora dealt with, or not, by those living in the Gulf today?
It's really fascinating if you come from the Atlantic world into the Indian Ocean, because there are a lot of differences. If you come in with an Atlantic mindset, the general history of slavery in the Indian Ocean looks quite unfamiliar, because unlike in the Atlantic, it was possible for people to be enslaved in the Indian Ocean and actually have a high status, to be entrusted with great sums of money and entrusted with great deal of power, even military power, in ways that would really be unthinkable in the, say, 18th century Atlantic context. So in many ways, the coming with a Western mindset, if you're coming from the United States or Europe into the Indian Ocean, it's tempting to come in with an Atlantic mindset, in which case you would expect to find people of African ancestry gravitating toward Pan-Africanism, thinking about things like reparations and thinking about demand for equal rights and equal treatment. And you have found remarkably little of that in the Western Indian Ocean, in the Gulf in particular. There hasn't really been a Western educated group of elites who have called for reparations. There hasn't really been a noticeable Pan-Africanist sentiment in the Gulf. And in some ways, if you're coming in with an Atlantic mindset, this might be upsetting for scholars of the Atlantic world. But I would argue that the context in the Gulf is quite a bit different. You're absolutely right that the Gulf considers itself, at least in official circles, to be a cosmopolitan setting, a place of great cultural mixing, or some of the countries will depict themselves in their museums and educational materials as a crossroads. And in some ways, this is something of a ruse. It's masking the very real history. One of the reasons why the Gulf is such a diverse place is because many people were brought there against their will as captives and worked as slaves. And now their descendants are living side by side as, you know, subjects of the sheikhs and sultans of the Gulf states today, in states that are not democracies but are monarchies. And so often when people ask me about the book, they ask, well, what happened to the descendants of enslaved Africans? Where are they? And I tell them they are still there. They're less, maybe less noticeable to outsiders, in part because there hasn't been a great deal of Pan-Africanism. There hasn't been a lot of recognition of, you know, sort of a Pan-African sentiment more broadly. And there hasn't been, you know, as much of a call from the descendants of Africans in the Gulf for that kind of identity. And I think there are a number of different ways to explain that. Certainly the Gulf's desire to appear as a cosmopolitan place is part of that. So in other words, there are very involved state projects, you know, in order to portray a history that in many ways masks the history of slavery. And so there are deliberate, you know, acts to sort of erase this history. And in the book, I talk about a few examples that come in educational materials printed in Arabic for students, you know, videos and professional productions that are designed to be for outsiders, that in some ways allow for the possibility that perhaps there was like a voluntary migration or something, or perhaps the reason why certain African musical and dance styles are present among communities in the Gulf is because, you know, perhaps Arab traders saw these things from the safety of their ships from a distance or something, rather than the very real, rather than the reality that people were, you know, who brought these traditions were enslaved. And so there are a lot of tensions involved in this. I think some very intentional forgetting. And then we also have to keep in mind, because these states are monarchies, not democracies, there's not the same requirement for transparency. There's not the same kind of expectation of availability of information. And so, you know, in some ways, doing archival research in the Gulf is complicated by that fact. That, you know, if there are very real motivations for states to kind of sweep this history under the rug, they can do that in ways that would be less possible in a democracy. But there are encouraging signs. One is just a few years ago, in some ways, this is, I would say, Qatar is maybe ahead of my country, the United States, because they actually opened a public museum dedicated to the history of slavery. And they did it you know, a few years ago. And I have had the chance to visit and see the exhibit. And I think it's actually done quite well. There's some aspects of it that I'm actually very pleased in. So, you know, in some ways, there are some really hopeful signs that states in the Gulf and populations in the Gulf are seeking out this history and demanding that it be told. And in some ways, it is being told. I think I guess if I have one hope for this book, it's that it would inspire a generation of scholars from within the Gulf who could do things that you know, I couldn't do. Maybe perhaps anthropologists and sociologists who could deal with some of the lasting legacies of captivity and enslavement in the Gulf in ways that weren't available to me using the historical documents that were available to me as a historian. So I think if there's one hope I would have is that this momentum, this progress, if you will, of people seeking out this history and wanting to know a bit more about their region's history, would be met by scholars from within the Gulf who would pursue this even further. In some ways, I hope that I've just kind of set the stage, kind of created a skeleton or an outline for people to go in and investigate further and tell this story in more detail.
Well, I really enjoyed reading your book, and hopefully those listening will take the time to pick it up and read a little bit further. Well, Matt, we've taken up a lot of your time. To end, can you tell us a little bit about any of your current projects?
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a treat talking with you, and I really appreciate the opportunity. It's a real honor. I do have a new project that I've been working on for the last few years. So this book has now been out for a few years, and so I've shifted further out into the Indian Ocean to do a kind of a follow-up study. So whereas this book is interested in what happens to the enslaved Africans who made it to the Gulf, I'm now interested in the history of enslaved Africans whose journey to the Gulf and other places was interrupted by the British Royal Navy. So I'm working on a project now on a group of people known as liberated Africans in the Indian Ocean. And a liberated African is a term that's actually comes from the Act of Abolition in 1807. It's a term that's applied only to the people who, enslaved Africans who are on slave ships that are seized by the Royal Navy. So we think there's a number of scholars who are now working on liberated Africans in the history of the Atlantic and Indian Ocean. And we think there's something in the neighborhood of 200 to 250,000 people who were taken off of slave ships by the Royal Navy well over 1,000, probably closer to 2,000, or maybe even more ships in the history of the 19th century. The process begins in 1808, and it continues right on through the 1890s. And in the second half of the 19th century, most of these captures are made in the Indian Ocean. They tend not to be the big European vessels that have a name and multiple masts, and many of them are bringing hundreds and hundreds of captives across the Atlantic. They tend instead to be smaller vessels that are captured on their way to the Gulf. And so I'm part of a group of scholars now who are kind of following this story. And fascinatingly, you might expect that these very well-intentioned abolitionists would free slaves. After all, that seems to be their goal. But instead, rather than simply taking people on shore and freeing them, apparently out of a fear that they would be massacred or re-enslaved, they insist on bringing them to a British port or a place where there's a significant British presence. And they, after the case of the slave ship is adjudicated, liberated Africans are never freed. They're indentured. And the thought in the 19th century is that this is because of white supremacist and racist ideas at the time, that Africans weren't really capable of appreciating their freedom. At any rate, they didn't want them to become dependent. They wanted them to be independent, which would come through attaining a marketable skill. So they were indentured to an individual who was tasked with, teaching them Christianity and teaching them a marketable skill. And in theory, the outcome should be a number of former slaves who are wheelwrights and coopers and blacksmiths and seamstresses. But this actually very rarely happens. Well over 90% of these captives taken off of slave ships instead end up being domestic workers, or working on plantations or in fields and doing effectively the same kind of work that they likely would have done had they been enslaved. And so there are all kinds of contradictions and paradoxes in this story, but I'm following each of the 10 places where liberated Africans in the Indian Ocean are taken. And I'm doing individual chapters on places like the Seychelles, Mauritius, the Cape of Good Hope, and Aden, Mombasa, and elsewhere, Bombay. And so I'm trying to trace the lives of these somewhere between 20 and 30,000 liberated Africans who were taken off of these slave ships in the 19th century. And it's been really fascinating. I have to say, I wrote chapter 5 of this book talking about this process, embarrassingly ignorant of how deep this history runs. I'm now following the story, and I'm excited to kind of follow up on that chapter and tell a story that is actually much more nuanced and much more complicated than I knew at the time I wrote this book. So it's been an exciting follow-up project, and I hope to have it available to readers in a few years. It's an ongoing project, and it's nowhere near complete, but Robin, as soon as it is, you'll be the first to know.
Well, thank you very much. It sounds fascinating. Be happy to read more. Thank you for listening to today's episode with Dr. Matthew Hopper, in which we explored Slaves of One Master, Globalization and Slavery in Arabia in the Age of Empire, published by Yale University Press in 2015. This is your host, Robin Morse. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.